And you're welcome, Alison. It's a great pleasure to have you here in Konstanz. And thank you all for coming. So Alison Barker studied biochemistry at Brown University in beautiful Rhode Island. Mm-hmm. And from where she decided to do a PhD in the study of the neural basis of larval zebrafish behavior, where she moved to Herwig Bayer when he was still in San Francisco. Then Herwig Bayer moved to Munich. She followed Herwig Bayer to then complete her PhD studies. This is where we've met and overlapped and had great discussions about a lot of things, and which actually probably triggered me to move into the zebrafish field. Then she decided to actually that larval zebrafish is a very boring system and completely radically switched gears and moved on to explore social behaviors in naked mole rat colonies, which will be the topic of our talk today. And then after being at the Max Planck, at the Max Delbruck Center in Berlin with Gary Lewin, she then got an offer from the Max Planck Institute of Brain Research in Frankfurt, where she now, 6 months ago, started her own lab to kind of explore the details of social communication in these colonies, developing new tracking techniques, and very excitingly so, kind of going back to her passion in circuit neuroscience, kind of now combining these two fields and going to bring some neuroscience to the study of social behavior in this fascinating system. So welcome, Alison, to Konstanz, and we are all looking forward to your talk.
Thank you, Armin. Thank you very much for the invitation. It's and a very nice introduction. It's a real pleasure to be here to talk about my own research. And so I'm just going to get into it. And so today I'm going to tell you, as there's been a lot of buildup, about the naked mole rat. But first, I want to provide a little background about why one, or especially I, might look into the naked mole rat. And so one of the sort of fundamental motivating questions for my research was to understand how vocal communication helps organize social groups, and ultimately how this can drive cooperation. And so we were really interested in looking at this intersection between complex social behaviors and complex vocal behaviors. And we know, for example, that there are many species, including our own, which are very good at these sort of specialized vocal behaviors, such as language. And if we also take a broader evolutionary approach, we see many of these similar intersections between complex sociality and vocal repertoire also in the non-human primates, in elephants, in dolphins, just to name a few. But then this gets at my second sort of motivating question, and that's to understand the neural circuits that are specialized to both encode and decode the social information, especially that which is in vocal cues. And so when we move forward and we try and look at this transition to understand, you know, where in the brain specializations have occurred that allow for this intersection, that becomes both ethically and technically difficult in some of these species that I've mentioned. And so that's what drew me to this creature right here, the naked mole rat. And so you're going to see a lot of naked mole rat photos today and some videos, so get ready. But here's the first introduction to the naked mole rat. So this is a subterranean rodent which is endemic to the eastern part of Africa in the countries of Kenya, Somalia, and Ethiopia. And despite the name, they are neither a mole nor a rat, but they're actually a small rodent. And so what's great about them is they're roughly the size of a mouse, so between 30 and 50 grams. And from a social perspective, they have an incredible colony organization. And so they live in these underground tunnels. And you can see in this very nice illustration here. And in the wild, although there's limited studies of them, it has been reported that some of these colonies can contain more than 300 members and span a distance of more than 1 kilometer underground. And then finally, naked mole rats are incredibly long-lived. So the oldest mole rat that we had in Berlin was, I think, 34 years old at last count. And so this also puts another demand on the social structure, where new members have to be constantly integrated. And they have to know their role and know how to communicate with one another over a longer time period. And so I should say that naked mole rats are also the only one of two eusocial mammals, and they have this very elaborate social structure, which is commonly found in the social insects, so bees, ants, and wasps. And I'm just diagramming this here in this kind of cartoon form, but basically the way that naked mole rat society is organized is that there's a queen, which is the single reproductive female. There are defenders, there's a series of workers, which are responsible for the acquisition of food and shelter. And what is really sort of key from my perspective in looking at this animal is that all of these tasks need to be coordinated within the larger unit for this colony to survive. And so also naked mole rats are can be housed in the lab quite well. And so here you can see my first colonies in the basement of Frankfurt. And so we can recreate these underground tunnel systems and these plastic transparent tunnels. And it's actually really fun to watch. I just want to point out that this is not sped up in any way. This is actual real-time movement. And so I'm just going to give you a few other glimpses of what naked mole rats in the lab look like, and then this is going to highlight some of the features about their behavior, which I'll discuss in a minute. So here you can see on a side view some of these interactions which you might have observed in the previous video, and you can see when two naked mole rats interact in the tunnel, the more dominant one will climb over the other, and this becomes very helpful later for determining the hierarchical structure. And then here you're going to hear some naked mole rats. So naked mole rats are also incredibly vocal, and I'll get back to that in a second, but I just wanted to highlight that. So here again you can see a still frame from this interaction where two mole rats are encountering one another in the tunnel, and these crossover events are actually highly predictive of the rank over time, and that's what you're seeing here on the right. These rankings are very stable, and they predict the queen. So we can perform these in a pseudo-random order to track the hierarchy of the colony over time. And then finally, naked mole rats are highly vocal, as you've already glimpsed in the first video there. And so I'm going to talk specifically about one type of vocalization today, but I just wanted to give you a little taste of the different types of sounds that naked mole rats make and in which context. So on the top here, you're going to hear a courtship song, which is from a male. And on the bottom here, you'll hear a more aggressive exchange between two workers. And so I also, so the naked mole rats also vocalize in our frequency range. So this is actually what I hear when I'm doing the experiments, which makes my job incredibly fun. And so when I started in Gary Lewin's lab in Berlin, he had several colonies. And there had been previously a paper published in the early 90s looking at the naked mole rat dictionary. But I wanted to investigate this a bit more, and so I spent a lot of time trying to decipher different sound types that the naked mole rats used. But today I'm going to talk about just one particular vocalization, the so-called soft chirp. And for those of you that are not familiar, I'm going to be presenting all the sound data as a spectrogram, which is just a transformation of the sound wave into its frequency components over time. And what you can see here in the schematized version of the soft chirp is that it's an actually a fairly simple sound, which has a fairly symmetrical upsweep and downsweep over time. And I should say that the naked mole rats, we think, make at least 25 distinct vocalizations. The soft chirp is the most commonly used vocalization, and it's commonly used as a greeting call, so especially in these exchanges when they're crossing over in the tunnels. And so the first question that we wanted to ask was then, do soft chirps convey some sort of social information? And so to do that, we created a pipeline for analyzing tens of thousands of soft chirps. And so we exploited several features of machine learning to come up with some automatic pipelines. And if anyone wants the details, we can talk about that later. But I just want to highlight the general workflow here. So we took several features from the sound wave itself, so features such as pitch and Wiener entropy, which are commonly extracted and used for bioacoustical classification. And then we also did a lot of work on the spectrogram itself. So we were able to transform the sound wave into a spectrogram, and then we traced the first harmonic of the soft chirp, and then extracted some additional features such as the peak frequency of the soft chirp, the duration of the soft chirp, and then we could fit a slope to the we could fit a parabola to the soft chirp, and then we extracted the slope of that. So in all told, we had eight features that we looked at. And I just want to highlight that all of this is publicly available, all the code and all the data. If anyone wants to play with it, please check it out. Okay, so then I said that we had these 8 sound features that we extracted, and then so what we did with them is we trained a type of machine learning algorithm called a random forest classifier, and the idea was that if there's some information in these 8 features that is predictive of certain social features, that the machine might be able to then use this information to make predictions about the identity or other features of the soft chirps from animals that it had never seen before. And so what you can see here is kind of a representation of this. So what we did is we split the data into a test set and a training set. And then we asked if the classifier that we trained was then able to predict the actual individual identity of different animals within the colony. And so you can see along the y-axis here, this is the true identity of 9 different subordinates in this colony and the queen. And then on the x-axis here, you can see the actual true identity. And so along the diagonal, it's the fraction of correct responses. And so I just want to highlight that since there's 10 options, if the classifier was performing completely at chance, it would have a 1 in 10 chance of being correct. And so we can see that the classifier actually performs very well, suggesting that there's information in these 8 sound features that is predictive of the individual's identity. And so we looked at 2 other colonies as well, so a smaller colony and then another colony of 10 individuals, and these results held up. And so then we were also interested in looking in if the soft chirps might encode other features. So we decided to look at colony identity. So the naked mole, for the naked mole rat in their normal lifestyle, the colony membership is very important for them. So what we did here is we looked at 4 different colonies. We again did our feature extraction, and this time, since we already knew that the classifier could be trained to recognize individuals, we made sure that individuals from each colony were not in the training and testing data set, and then we performed the same experiment. And so we found again, quite to our surprise, that we had a very nice prediction rate. Before we go further, I just wanted to share a fun fact. So we actually named all of our colonies after Game of Thrones houses. So I'm gonna go back into that nomenclature there. So if any of you are fans, this maybe adds another dimension to the talk. So we'll continue with that. So what we showed first, which was quite interesting, sort of from an information perspective, is that there is potentially sound features within this one vocalization that can predict information about individual and colony identity, but we actually had no idea if the naked mole rats actually use this information, and this became a very important question. So to test that, we did some behavioral experiments. So you can see on the top here a schematic of the behavioral setup, which was quite simple. So we had 3 interconnected chambers. The naked mole rat was placed in the center chamber and had a choice of moving into the 2 connected chambers, each which had a speaker and a microphone, so we could both play back audio information and then record what the animal responded. And so what you can see here on the left is first we just looked at the place preference, so where did the animal prefer to spend time? And so we found that actually the animal preferred to spend time in the chamber where there was soft chirps or in artificial sounds in general, but they didn't seem to have a preference based on the colony playback. And so that was a bit unexpected, so we decided to investigate this a bit further. And we looked at when the animal responds. So here you can see in the center panel, what I'm showing is a set of experiments done on animals from House Targaryen. And you can see that when we played the House Baratheon stimuli, which is indicated by the black arrow, we don't see any responses. The same when we present stimuli from another colony, Dothraki, but when we present stimuli that were recorded from the animal's home colony, so here on the bottom, we see consistent responses that are very temporally synced to the stimuli. And so we, of course, quantified this over many colonies and many animals, and we found that the result was quite robust. So what you can see here is when we compare the response rate to a sound from the home colony versus the foreign colony, the response rate is much increased for the home colony stimuli. So this suggested that the animals were actually able to recognize members of their own colony, and this drives a specific behavioral response. However, this didn't tell us if the animal is actually recognizing the specific individual, because these were sounds that were recorded from the colonies, or if they were recognizing something more specific about the colony, what we're calling colony dialect, so specific features of the soft chirp for each colony. So to test this, we made a series of artificial stimuli. And so here we manipulated just two of these features that we originally used in our classifier. And so you can see this in the inset up here. So we looked at the peak frequency of the sound, which is the maximal frequency of the first harmonic of the soft chirp. And then we also looked at the asymmetry, so the difference between the start and end frequency of the sound. And I'm just plotting these two here so you can kind of see the difference. And so we made, for example, one, here's the example of one artificial stimuli that was still characterized as belonging to House Baratheon, but did not overlap with any individual in the colony. And then we could test this as well on our classifiers, and we found that indeed all of the artificial stimuli that we then tested behaviorally were predicted to belong to the, in this case, colony Baratheon. So here's just the behavioral result where we were able to confirm this. So in the first panel, you can see that we tested this again. So this is a new colony, and we tested actual playbacks from colony members. Then we also tested the artificial stimuli, and you can see that the animal also consistently responds. But when we test artificial stimuli that for another colony, this response is gone. We also dissected this a bit further, and so we looked at single features, so just the peak frequency or just the asymmetry, and we found that in some cases there were responses to the peak frequency when that was matched to the average of the colony, but the asymmetry did not seem to be sufficient alone to drive behavioral responses. So you can see all of this summarized here. And I just want to highlight that this worked in multiple colonies. And then finally, what we also tested was whether or not vocal cues or auditory cues alone were sufficient, because of course social communication is a multimodal stimulus or in the wild, or actually in the lab, so in any social interaction. So we basically tested sense from another colony and played back vocalizations from the home colony. And while the response rate, the animals were worse at this task, performed worse at this task, the result was still there. So this suggested that even in the presence of a conflicting olfactory cue, the animals still are able to recognize the vocal dialect from their own colony. Okay, so then this raised a series of very interesting questions, the first of which were how might these vocal signatures be maintained? And so we had an interesting situation that occurred in the lab where we had a series of colonies in which we lost the queen, and actually one colony in particular, which kind of fortuitously was named House Stark before this happened. But I was doing long-term recordings from this colony, and we had a period where there was a stable queen, and then she was murdered, and then we had another queen that rose, and then she also died. And so what we were able to do over time is look at periods when we had recordings of the soft chirp dialect when there was a queen and then when there was anarchy. And so we again trained our classifiers to look at this, and what we found was quite surprising is that when there is a queen, the overall cohesiveness of the dialect, which is reflected in the ability of the classifier to accurately recognize it, is much higher. And when we transition to phases of anarchy, this goes almost to chance levels. And so we can look at this on a more individual level. And so what I'm showing here again are just two of these eight features, so the peak frequency plotted against asymmetry. And we had four subordinate individuals, which you can see the variability of their soft chirps in subsequent periods of anarchy and when the new queen arose. And I think it's quite clear that when the queen is there, the overall variability of the of the soft chirps of an individual is much decreased. Then we also wanted to to know then, well, how are vocal signatures learned? So at what point in the life of the animal do they learn these vocal signatures? And I think this is an important question because the queen experiments show that there's some plasticity, it seems, in the adult, or some ability of the vocal signature to change. And we wanted to kind of look at a more developmental perspective and see when this arises. So we did some very classical behavioral experiments where we had some cross-fostering experiments where we moved a series of pups early in life to another colony. In this case, we had two pups from House Stark, which were orphaned during one of the queen overthrows, and so we managed to move them into two separate colonies, and then we could track their vocalizations over time, and using these classifiers that we could previously train, that we had previously trained, we could then ask what soft chirp dialect are they using later in life? And so we tested these after a 6-month period. And so you can see here that both of the pups that were moved from House Stark to one of the other colonies, in the end, ended up using the vocal dialect of the adoptive colony. We were able to perform this experiment a third time. And I should just say that these experiments are actually quite difficult to do because we can't synchronize the breeding of the colonies in the lab. So we, in fact, got very lucky that we were able to have simultaneous litters. So in this experiment, we were able to move one pup into another colony and simultaneously track the vocalizations of siblings, foster siblings. And again, we found, maybe not surprisingly, that the two colonies that were born in House Martell ended up speaking the Martell dialect, and also the pup that was transplanted from the Targaryen colony also ended up speaking the Martell dialect. And so this suggested that this this use of dialect is not a purely genetic feature, but something that actually can be learned. And the extent of this learning is something that we're still actively investigating. But I just wanted to show you then here just a quick summary. So yes, all the foster pups ended up using the dialect of their foster colony. We had just a little, a few more tidbits of interesting data. So we had later another colony where we lost a queen, and we found that this actually held up as well. So because we didn't have subsequent periods of queen loss, we couldn't test this across periods of anarchy and queen, but we could ask the question, well, how does the classifier perform when compared to the other colonies when there's a queen and when there's not? And you can see the same effect here quite clearly, that when one of the colonies loses its queen, the ability of the classifier to distinguish its dialect falls apart quite rapidly. And then we could also look at this on the level of individual jobs within the colony. So if we look at the variability of the queens across multiple colonies, or the breeding males, or some of the subordinates, I think this is actually one of my favorite results, is that you see that actually, despite the fact that each colony has a very clear kind of separation in terms of the features that they use in the soft chirp, the breeding males consistently have the most variability. And I think this kind of makes sense when you think about some of the other vocal behaviors that they do, because they're constantly singing to the queen. And then one other question that often comes up is people ask, well, how is this dialect determined? So one hypothesis would be that individuals are always trying to match the queen. So we tried to test that a little bit by, again, going back into our data set. And instead of using a training data set which took into account like half of the population of the colony, we instead just trained the classifier with either the queen or a single subordinate, and we asked how well then the classifier performed, and the hypothesis was that if everyone was matching the queen, if we used her vocalizations to train the classifier, it would perform much better. And in fact, in the end, it seemed to be pretty consistent across all the colonies. One of the colonies was more separable than the others, but it didn't seem to matter if it was the queen or the subordinate that was trained. So I just want to then conclude with this part. So this work has already been published, and then I'm going to talk about a few things which haven't been published yet. What we showed is that naked mole rats use vocalizations, specifically this soft chirp, to communicate individual and colony identity. that in fact these colony dialects are quite distinct and that they can drive different behavioral decisions, so this response or no response. We have some evidence that they can be learned. And finally, we have evidence that social context is important. So when there's a stable queen, this is also reflected in the stability of the dialect. So moving forward, sort of the directions of my own lab, we're really now trying to move into the brain and understand how the social identity is determined. And so I was hoping that we would have some data here, but instead just this is the direction for the future. So we're hoping to begin by starting to image in the auditory cortex and ask how different vocalizations, either from different colonies or from the queen or the worker, or even the individuals own vocalizations, how those are represented on a neuronal level. And we're also interested in understanding how this social identity is maintained. So we know that when the social structure falls apart, this is reflected in the vocalizations. And so now we want to look at this on a more detailed level. We want to look at sort of social network analysis to understand which individuals are talking to each other and how these dynamics change when the queen is lost. And so for the last few minutes, I just want to shift gears and talk about another project that we're trying to finish up now. And this is work that I'm still continuing with my postdoc advisor in Berlin, Gary Lewin. And we were interested in not only so how these dialects are used, how they're maintained, but how did they evolve? And so I think that the naked mole rat, as I mentioned, is belongs to a family of African mole rats. You can see the phylogenetic tree here. And across this family, there's very different social behaviors. So the naked mole rat is eusocial, so is the Damaraland mole rat, which you can see here, which is found in the Kalahari. But throughout the family, there are also many other species that are solitary. And so if you kind of look at the evolutionary history of the family, we can kind of map this or follow this and look at the ecological niche, and we can also look at the behavior of animals along the eastern coast of Africa. And so with some collaborators at the University of Pretoria, we've had access to many of these animals to do both vocalization recordings and then also some neuroanatomy. And basically, the main hypothesis that we had is that when we look at this family, we see increased sociality. And so we hypothesized that this increased cooperation, this increased sociality would be accompanied by increased vocal communication. So that in this way, the Bathyergidae family would be a powerful model for understanding the evolution of the social brain. And so we also thought that this expanded vocal repertoire is going to be reflected in the underlying neural circuitry. But first, a very obvious question is then, how is this implemented? So, what does one begin to assay? So you could imagine that they might have more sound types, they might have different modulations of sounds, different usage rate, or different usage context. So we spent a lot of time making recordings from some of the other species. And so I'm just going to show a few of them to you today and just give you a little taste of the data. So this is Fucumus damarensis, the Damaraland mole rat. This is the other eusocial species. And so I'll just play some of the vocalizations for you, and you can see if they sound similar or not. OK, and then here's another example. So I think they sound a bit different from the naked mole rats. Let's see. Okay, then this is a Cryptomys hottentotus pretoria, or the high-filled mole rat. This is actually local to the area where we work in South Africa. And this is a moderately social species. They live in a groups of about 6 to 12. And so here you can see, here's some of them. Okay, and then finally, the last one, this is Bathyergus suellus. So this is quite a large animal, actually. They're roughly the size of a rabbit. They are solitary, but they do sometimes make vocalizations. And then here is one example. Okay, so we spend a lot of time with these animals, and we got a lot of vocalization recordings, which we're still analyzing, but I just want to give you some of the quick highlights. So what we found is that the vocal repertoire does increase with sociality, not as much as we thought. And I'm not sure that you can fully appreciate this here, but there, these are the main sounds on the bottom here of the adult naked mole rat vocalizations. And we actually found much more overlap than we thought. So for example, domorensis we think has about 14 vocalizations, whereas the naked mole rat has about 17. And we're still, so we've validated, we've classified all of these manually, but we're now looking at sort of unbiased clustering techniques. So I'm gonna resist giving a final number, but we do see that the naked mole rats tend to have more sounds, this was actually not the most, we actually expected the result to be more dramatic. What instead we found is that the vocalization rate increases a lot. So here what you're seeing over a period of about 3 hours are vocalizations from four individuals. So we managed to have a very small naked mole rat colony of four individuals, and we matched this in size to the other species. For the solitary species, we put them in pairs and then merged the data. So basically, you're looking at the vocalization rate of four animals across time. And you can see on the top that the naked mole rats basically never stop vocalizing. Which is quite remarkable, I think. And then if we quantify this, so if we look at the vocalization rate per minute, again, the naked mole rats are really quite striking. And I think this is kind of interesting when you think about this from an evolutionary perspective. I mean, they're drawing a lot of attention to themselves. They're also, it is metabolically demanding to be vocalizing all the time. And so this suggests that there's some very significant reason that they do this. And then we can break apart which type of vocalizations they were using. And maybe not surprisingly, the naked mole rat is using the soft chirp predominantly. And so we're still trying to investigate what exactly that means. But one other approach that we've taken is we now are looking at the brains of all these individuals, and we're looking at what changes in terms of neural activity when they have sound exposure both to neutral sounds and social sounds. And so here's a naked mole rat brain where you can see some CFOS staining, which is a marker of neural activity. And so we start to see specializations, which is actually quite nice. And so my very very ambitious student is working on this still in Berlin. We now have brains from the other four species, and she's and we're going to try and map differences in neural activity in response to social stimuli. And then also in collaboration with Katja Novak's group at the FU in Berlin, we have made a de novo transcriptome for some of the species, and we've sequenced different levels of our mRNAs that are active in different brain regions. And so we're doing, this is the most recent result. Everything has been sort of successfully annotated at the moment. And so now we're looking into different gene expression changes across brain regions. Okay, so with that, I want to thank a lot of people. I want to thank my advisor in Berlin for introducing me to the naked mole rats, and my two fantastic students there, and then a host of really amazing collaborators throughout the world, our funding sources, and then also the Max Planck Institute in Frankfurt for giving me the opportunity to have my own group there. And then I think there's time for questions.
So I guess that's a quick question, and thanks for the great talk. So how do they pick the queen? So once the queen dies, is there like fights and stuff going on? Are they really just talking a lot and then come to a conclusion?
Yeah, I would love if that was the case. So we don't actually know. There is a lot of fighting, so I can comment on generally, when there's an overthrow and it's successful, the new queen kind of ascends very quickly, and she orchestrates the overthrow, as far as we can tell. But in House Stark, for example, where we had the two queens lost, they still, to this day, don't have a new queen. So I think normally in the wild, then they would disperse and try and form new colonies. In the lab situation, yeah, they're kind of stuck together. So But that's a fascinating question, right? Like, how do you decide you want to challenge for the queenship? What changes in your brain to make that happen? How do you coordinate that? These are all things we're very keen to figure out.
Thanks.
Hi, thanks for the great talk. So I have so many questions, but I'm taking you to lunch. So I will, I'll just ask one for now. For the queen as well, I was wondering if you had looked at, like you mentioned that the idea that maybe the other members of the colony are learning the dialect from the queen. And then you also mentioned there were some times when the queen changed. So I was wondering if you looked at what happens when when a colony gets a new queen, like is there a distinct dialect? And can you maybe use those natural changes to see, and also does the queen's dialect change when she becomes queen?
I think, so yes to the first question, we have looked at that. We had this idea that maybe there's this template language that they all go back to and it just gets messy and then the queen brings them back on track. And we think that that's not the case actually. So they seem to have sort of a new dialect. We really have to do more experiments to kind of play with this to really figure out what exactly is changing. And I feel like one thing that we really need to do as well is look at the other sounds. So we're looking at one vocalization. Yes, it's the most commonly used and it's very important for this recognition and this exchange, but I suspect that what's changing when an individual becomes the queen is that they learn to use these other vocalizations as well. And do they learn or is this innate? How is that? I mean, that's something that we're also very interested in because there are certain vocalizations that only the breeders use. And we don't know to what extent that's inherited. So still an active investigation, but yeah.
Cool, thanks. I'd love to chat more.
Hey, thanks for the wonderful call. Two questions, actually. One is very quick. Just wondering how you keep track of the individual identity. And the other one is with these dialects, what do you think they're useful for in the wild? Like, how often do the colonies actually encounter each other? Like, how is it important for them to know where they come from? Or
Yes, so the first question, we use RFID chips. So all the animals are subcutaneously implanted around 6 months, we can track that, which is quite easy. And then this other question, I'm really glad that you asked this because I love giving this answer because I think we don't have a clear answer, so it's something I think about all the time. One idea is, of course, yes, that you might want to use it as a control for strangers. So to say, okay, if a new animal is coming in, there's some sort of metric for identification. We don't know that much about these interactions in the wild. I mean, they do happen, and especially when a new colony will split off, that might be one way that helps them stay separated. But I think that there's another hypothesis that's equally interesting, and that this may be some sort of measure of internal conformity. So when you want to have everyone who's following the rules very closely, you want to make sure you have these checks when you interact with everyone that no one is being too, fun or they're all following the same exact rule, and the vocal output is a quick way to make sure that everyone's in line. And so I think that might be also one way that it's used.
Do you see that an individual that is a bit of an outlier in terms of vocalization gets molested more or something?
There is one really cool naked mole rat subtype that I didn't talk about today called the disperser morph. And so there are individuals who will go through this metabolic change. They get a really fat neck, and then in the wild they will try and leave the colony. And they also happen in the lab. So we've had a few that have escaped and tried to do this. That is I think when we have a few more of those over time, we can look and see if the if their dialect is changing, but I don't have an answer for that yet. But
thank you.
Hi, thank you so much for this fascinating talk. I had another question about the maintenance of the dialect when the queen is gone, because you mentioned a few things about the breeding males, that they're second in the hierarchy and that they're constantly singing to the queen and that they're also the most distinct in their soft chirps. Do you think it could be that when the queen is gone, because they stop singing, that's what causes the derivation in the whole colony?
Oh, I mean, that's an interesting perspective. I think of everything as female-centric, that it's all about the queen, but it could also be male-centric. Yeah, I think that that's possible. I don't know how often the other individuals hear the courtship song. I mean, and when you think about in the wilds, it's these tunnel systems that could be 1 kilometer, that might not be enough to get the transmission through. But I think your instincts about the males being outliers are very helpful to think about, because they're sort of immune to this conformity. And they're also, I think this has been shown in birds, for example, that there's hormonal changes in brain regions that are responsible for singing. And so I think that this may be happening in the naked mole rats as well. The males are and the queen are the only ones that have these high levels of reproductive hormones circulating. And so we suspect that when this suppression is lost and we don't actually know how that's working, that maybe these hormonal changes are also happening as well. And so that's why we see more of like a male phenotype in the other animals.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for that wonderful talk. That was really, really impressive. I'm particularly interested in the evolutionary comparison. And, you know, to be open, that's something we're also very interested in my group. And I'd love your thoughts on whether you think the evolutionary process is equipping these different species with the machinery to perform all of these vocalizations, and then that's called upon differentially, which would be reflected in, I guess, your CFOS kind of approach, or if evolution has driven novel neuroanatomy that allows for increased repertoire size. Because just eyeballing one of the graphs very quickly, it looked like there were massive differences in the usage of the different types of communication, and maybe entire deficits, which is sort of what we see in the fish, that some lineages just cannot perform some behaviors that seem to be very important in social organization.
I think we should definitely chat more about this. I think this is a question that I constantly think about, like how much of this is a neuroanatomical change versus like so we don't know. I think that that's easy to check. We can get the larynx out of these animals and we can make some predictions about what type of sounds are possible. That's kind of something that's on the back burner, like when I find the right like neuroanatomist or like sort of, you know, vocal tract anatomist to help out with that. But I think that's why this whole family is so great, because there's actually not that much divergence on an evolutionary time scale. And so, yeah, and that's why I was kind of surprised that there seemed to be, like, it seems possible that certain species can make these other sounds, at least that they do, but they don't use them. So actually, I'm just kind of spiraling here, but I don't actually know. And I think that this is why we're looking in the brain and why we're going to keep doing everything. And I would be surprised and happy with either result. I mean, I think that that's, and then of course, this is just a rodent model, and it's great to have a broader perspective where you can look across different species. And that's, yeah, that would be the dream, so.
Can I just quickly follow up? Can you produce deficits by sort of the wolf child syndrome, by rearing individuals in isolation? Is that, ethically with a rodent, I suppose that's an absolute nightmare.
I'm happy to say that we do have now approval to do this, sort of. So we will isolate them in smaller groups. And that is one experiment that we definitely want to try. Not just the isolation, but also a different sound environment, either white noise or, you know, doubling the frequency. We really want to see what the extent of the vocal plasticity is. And yeah, maybe getting back to your first question, that's an area where it's acted. Maybe there's just more plasticity. And we do know actually from other studies in the naked mole rat that they do have like periods of neurogenesis, which are longer. I mean, they're also very long-lived. So these things might all be linked. They might just have a longer plasticity range or period in their brain. So, yeah.
Cool. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks. That was a great talk. I was curious to hear your thoughts about kind of the quantity of information being transmitted within a system and how that relates to the frequency of vocalization, particularly when, at least in the naked mole rats, what you're seeing is a massive increase in this one call type. And I was curious, I was just thinking on other lines of like, if you're constantly vocalizing yourself, you're not necessarily hearing it just seems like a cacophony of vocalizations, and
yeah,
I'm curious
really
what you
is,
think
yeah.
about the informational content of that.
This is a fascinating question. So we're playing around with this as well, like kind of the social information transfer within a vocalization. We have a very impoverished preparation, actually, where we're just looking at one vocalization, and we're actually mostly looking at spectrogram features. So to do that, we're going back to the raw audio data, and we're analyzing that. I think this is why we need better behavioral tracking over time to look at all of these interactions. We did this because it was, well, it's kind of the easy first approach. But I think that's exactly one direction that we want to go in. And I think this is, at the same time, why it's really cool to go into the brain as well, because we basically have this kind of cocktail party effect all the time where the animals are having these conversations on top of each other, but how do they know which conversation to attend to? And of course, you can model that, but I also really want to see what the network dynamics in the brain are while this is happening. So very cool, but yeah, I don't know. Ask me in a few years, and I hope we have an answer.
Janine Grütter asks, dear Alison, thank you for this great talk. I was wondering how long it takes for a naked mole rat to learn the new dialect. Does that also depend on age, as with children, where we know that they have time-sensitive windows for learning languages? Do you see any parallels?
So I think, again, we only did this in three, I don't really know where to look, but we only managed to do this in three pups, and this is something that we need to do again to play around with this time window and see if there is this critical period. I suspect that it might be slightly more flexible because we do see some plasticity in the adult during these queen transitions. Maybe you noticed in the slides that I showed, it seemed that when we moved the pups later in development, that they didn't learn as well. But this is, again, only an N of three, so I think this is something that we need to test. But I suspect that there will be some parallels.
Great, thank you. Then we have one question by Christine. I would love to hear more about the random forest classifier. Is it a neural network? And how does the dataset creation and training process work? Is it new that machine learning plays a role in your research?
I think so. Maybe this is an email me later and I can give you some details, but just generally, yeah, I think, so it is a neural net that we use partially, but not for the random forest classifier. We actually use like many different types of machine learning. And I think, the reason that we did this is we realized we had like a backlog of human processing capacity. So people have looked at this before and they just didn't manage to like process the same amount of data. So I think that really when you can train a computer to do something for you, that is a huge advantage. I would be happy to chat more if the person who asked the question wants to.
I will just quickly read out Aya Goldstein's question. Thanks for the great talk. Did you try to correlate between movement or average group size and calls interpulse intervals of different species? Is it possible that they also use these calls for orientation and animals that move or expect to meet more neighbors in the colony emit those more calls? Sorry.
We haven't looked at any of that. I think those are all really fascinating questions. Most of these interactions were done when we had a few animals together interacting, not the whole colony, because we had a bit of a triangulation issue. For the other species, I think this is something that we can definitely do in the wild, which would be great. And so, I have not a good answer for that, but I think those are all really good good questions. Yeah.
Thank you so much. So I saw that Armin kindly just typed in Alison's email in the chat, so whoever wishes to get in contact with her, please do so. Are there any more questions from the room, maybe? Now is still time. Okay, does not look like it, but I think we had a great discussion here. And so thank you all again for chiming in and coming to today's seminar, and most of all to Alison for giving this wonderful talk. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you all.
And Armin for hosting.